So, I'm not going to carry on with that. I'm going to say, without further ado, please welcome Rick Passaportis.
Good morning, everybody. I've got to be honest, I'm absolutely stunned that there are so many people interested in listening to my Greek, excuse the expression, bullshit. I'm not quite sure how I wound up here. Obviously, someone in the audience, and I have my suspicions as to who might have sold me. And one of my relatives is sitting with a black cap there, nodding his head, and knows that it's coming his way sometime. But listen, it's a pleasure to be here, and I'm going to start off by reading a passage of a document that I've been laboring over for a number of years. And it says here, Passaportis Greek Family History. The details that I've managed to piece together as detailed in this document are, as far as I've been able to ascertain, are factual. This historical story is made up from photographs, documents, letters, and verbal stories that I was told by various members of the family when asked to tell me what they could recall about their lives and the family history. The paternal or Passaportis side of the family is reputed to have originally resided in the city of Constantinople and were forced to leave following the Ottoman invasions in 1453, when Constantinople's name was changed to become Istanbul and become the capital of the new Ottoman Empire, now the modern-day Turkey. Constantinople was the original seat of the Christian Church, and in 1054 a split occurred, and that is when the Greek Orthodox Church refused to accept that the Pope was omnipotent. So the Catholic Church broke away. And the Roman division moved to Rome, becoming the Catholic Church, whilst the Eastern division remained in Constantinople under the inimical Patriarch of Constantinople, where it remained until the Ottoman invasion and occupation in 1453. At this time, it resulted in the Greek Orthodox Church having to relocate to Alexandria. And you will understand as I go through the family history why Alexandria assumes importance in our family history. Where did I get up to? Right, so in Alexandria in Egypt, where the Patriarch of the Greek Orthodox Church, responsible for the whole of Africa, remains today. So this school actually comes under the Patriarch in Alexandria. Where I'm coming to is that our family name at this time was not Passaportis. It was Hagiagiru. Hagi in the Greek Orthodox religion was a prefix given to a family that had visited the seat of the Orthodox Church in Constantinople. The Ottomans forced all Orthodox Greeks out of their homes and villages, resulting in mass migration, with survivors seeking refuge in the surrounding states. Our family managed to make its way to Cyprus, where they settled in a tiny village of Drusha, located in the mountains above the town of Paphos. The Aguru family remained in Drusha and maintained small fields where they grew local crops to sustain the family. They were very, very poor. At the beginning of the 1900s, the family, like most of the rural Cypriot population at that time, suffered from deteriorating economic conditions, and it was decided that the eldest son, Neophytos Savas Hagiagiru, who was in his teens, having been born in 1888, would be sent to join his uncle in Egypt, in Alexandria actually, where he had established a trading business. To back up the family. Oh, Crocky, don't tell me this thing's not going to work. What have I done?
No, you've done nothing.
I've done nothing. Well, I haven't got it on the screen.
Okay.
Sorry, I am almost... there we go. Right.
How we doing?
There we go. Right. So, ladies and gentlemen, to back up the story about the family originally being Hagiagiru, there is a copy of my grandfather's original birth certificate from the Greek Orthodox Church in the village of Drusha. And you will see it is dated 1888. And if you look there, you will see Neophytos Sava Hagiagiru. It's absolutely cast in concrete that the original family name of the Passaportis that wound up here That was the original name. So I come back to where my grandfather was sent from Cyprus to join his uncle in Alexandria. And obviously being poor, they must have put him on a pretty substandard boat, because halfway between Cyprus and Alexandria, the boat sank. And poor old Hagi Ogiriu floundered around, managed amongst others that survived to hold on to something that kept him afloat until a British warship pulled alongside and fished the survivors out of the water. They were then taken to Alexandria and dumped on the quayside. And of course, Alexandria at that time was under British occupation. And along came, let's call him Smotherington Smashforth, of Her Majesty's Egyptian colonial regime, and they started to interrogate the survivors. And when they got to Hagi Ogiriu, they demanded his passport. A bit ridiculous, having survived floundering around in the Mediterranean. He didn't have anything, and more than that, he didn't speak English. So by the time they had finished interrogating him, he was quite convinced that his new name was to be Passaportus. Okay, whether the verification of this fact is 100%, but looking at his original birth certificate and having arrived in this country, he certainly arrived in this country as Neophytos Savas Passaportus. And I think the word passport was bastardized into a Greek version, Passaportus. So that's how we arrived. So having arrived in Alexandria, according to my grandfather, my papu, he was not that pleased to see another mouth to feed. So I said to him, if you want to join the business, you join at the bottom. And he was put on a dhow, a trading dhow that came down the east coast of Africa. And it was loaded with things like sugar and salt and gunpowder and cloth. And they came down the east coast of Africa trading, picking up ivory and skins and spices. Now you must understand that this little Mediterranean warp, my grandfather, having survived a drowning and now put on a dhow, and if any of you have ever had the misfortune of sailing in the open sea on a dhow, it is the most uncomfortable boat you could ever be on. Not only does it go up and down, it yaws badly. By the time he got to Beira, and now with the dhow full of leaking tusks and stinking hives, he decided, for me, I will die if I go back to Alexandria. So he jumped ship. And he managed to secure a passage on a resupply wagon that were coming up to Umtali. And I read in his own diary, written in pidgin English, a pencil, in a little notebook, his account. And he was not allowed to ride on the wagons. He was allowed to hold the stirrup. And it was classified that he wasn't European. So he became a shooter boy and earned his keep by shooting for the column that eventually arrived in Umtali. And from there, he made his way to Fort Salisbury. And from Fort Salisbury, he got a job driving cattle to Fort Victoria, where the railhead was. And each drove, he got paid 2 and 6 pence, half a crown. And he kept it in a sock around his neck. And eventually he had enough to buy a grub stake in a small farm outside Hartley called Renegal Farm. So the family then, I think I've got this magic stick, let's see if it works. No, it doesn't want to work. Sorry? Hey, I've got to point it at the computer. Still doesn't work. I promise you, anything that's this type that I touch doesn't work. So please, just bear with me. Right. So, having got there and eventually getting to Renegal Farm, that is the original photograph of the Passaportus family that eventually derive or emerge from Renegal. This thing doesn't even want to work either. Right, so, up in the top left-hand corner is the new Neophytos Savas Passaportus. And the lady on the extreme right here, there, is what was my grandmother. My paternal grandmother. And then you have Papu's two brothers, Agirio and, is it working?
No, no, no.
Oh, there we go, great. So they're the two brothers who subsequently came out from Cyprus. You have Agirio and you have Theophani. And there is their one daughter, Eva, who married Sava Profitis of Ambassador Hotel. Across there is Perry Passaportis, who set up a trading emporium in Maradera. And that little wimp there turned out to be my father. There was subsequently another boy born after that who became Rywin's Furnishers, Uncle Gora, Eva Gora. And so that was the original family at Renegal Farm. Let's see if this works now. No, we've gone backwards. Right, so Hartley Greek community in 1920 at Renegal Farm, Fortini and Neophyto both seated on the, see if I can get this to work, yeah, there they are there, the two of them. And they were renowned in the Hartley area for being great entertainers. And they did amongst the Greek community. And please understand, this is not a whinge, it's fact. The Greeks in those days were totally ostracized. They were not allowed to live in municipal areas. And as you will see as I go on, you will see that they were actually forced to have a registration card. Let's see if that comes along. No. Okay, so that's when Papu married my yaya, and a wedding party, 1916. We'll come on to this gentleman. This is on my grandmother's side, Fortini. That was her elder brother, and the family originally was in Alexandria. And he was a lieutenant in the Imperial Egyptian Army, serving with the British, and he was killed. But what happened is one morning he came home and said to the family, "You do not go to school today. There is a problem." And of course it was the start of riots, etc. He never made it home after that, he was killed. And the family then decided, originally there were three brothers and three sisters, George Savides being the eldest and the breadwinner. So the rest of the family decided, with the insurrections and stuff that was going on in Alexandria at the time, that they should move south to the British colonies. So they made their way down the Nile and through Sudan, and eventually wound up in Tanzania. Yeah, gone the wrong way. Right, there is the Savides family. So, Fortini. And that is Amalia. That is my grandfather, Papu. And the two Savides brothers. Okay, Adonis and Neophytos and Pericles. So they eventually got to Tanzania, and the eldest daughter was married off to a Greek Tanzanian sisal farmer who was a lot older than her, probably about 30 years older. Extremely rich, but subsequently found out amongst the family, and his name was never mentioned apart from that bastard. Because he was so jealous of his young wife that he never let him leave the farm. She became so traumatized by the whole thing that one day she went into the pantry and poured liquid paraffin over herself and her two children and torched the family. Hence, his name was never repeated. The remainder of the family, those two brothers and the two daughters, two sisters there, made their way and eventually arrived in Hartley. They settled in Hartley, and the two brothers managed to set up a hairdressing business. And they became very, very popular in the Hartley area amongst the farmers' wives and the traders' wives. thereby hangs a tale, because they became so popular and would eventually run out of town and had to immigrate to South Africa because they were doing more than just hairdressing. And a few husbands were not terribly impressed. Okay, so they left behind Fortuny. Sorry, go back. They left behind Fortuny, obviously married to Neophyto, and these three moved down to Johannesburg, where they established themselves in Johannesburg, and Amalia was married off to funny enough, another Savides. And they owned a huge confectionery business in South Africa. So that brings the emigration of the Passaportus family down to here to a conclusion. Papu obviously worked very hard. If you look at that caption there, it says a day's work in Hartley, 1920. And if you look on the bottom, there's a filthy great python, there's buck, there's rabbits, and I think that's how he spent his life. And that shotgun that he's holding there, I currently have. It was made by Lewis and Sons specifically for him, and I've had to have the butt extended because he was a typical Greek, quite short, so the butt ended up too short on my arm. Okay, and the reason I've got my height is because of the other side of the family. That originally came from Ireland and from England, and they immigrated to South Africa, both sides, to South Africa in 1820. Landed in the area of King Williamstown, and they eventually occupied a small farm in the district of Pedi. Okay, remember I mentioned that the Passaportus family in Hartley were very hospitable. They used to hold picnics on the Umfuli River, which was on one of the boundaries of Redigo Farm. Lovely picture there. There is my father, who came or was educated. In fact, he was the first Greek boy to go to Prince Edward after the, I can't remember, the Aliens Act. And I have researched, and I cannot find where that act was originally repealed that allowed Greeks and Italians and Portuguese to now become European. But he actually was homeschooled originally, and then was the first Greek boy to go to Prince Edward. And if you actually see one of the pictures here of him as a young guy, I'm not surprised he was given a hard time when he walked into the dormitory. With a name like Theophani Lefkios Passaportis, well, they gave him a hard time. Anyway, he ended up at school and was determined to prove he was as good as everybody else. He ended up with six colours. He was the cadet lieutenant. He was Victor Adorum. Subsequently left school and for a short time he had to renaturalise. And I have the papers there to prove that he now became a British, Southern Rhodesian British citizen. And he spent a short time in the Ministry of Education. War broke out and he then volunteered. And as a sergeant instructor, him and his brother, Perry, who is Dan's grandfather, who is the one that set up the trading emporium in Marandera, they volunteered. My father went across to England, was selected to go to Sandhurst and was commissioned into the Sherwood Foresters and served in the Sherwood Foresters and Lincolnshire Regiment in North Africa, Italy, and subsequently in Greece. In fact, he joined General Scobie's staff because he obviously spoke Greek. Perry, he joined, I think it was 263 Squadron, and served with the Rhodesian Squadron in North Africa. He was a gunner armourer, and served on typhoons up in North Africa. The lovely tale there is that he, in Cairo, on furlough, stole an American Jeep and was subsequently arrested by the military police and incarcerated. He managed to get a message to his officer brother and my father managed to get back to Egypt, and he managed to make a trade using silk stockings and cigarettes to get his brother out of jail, and they went back to fight the war. So, the family. There is the Pasiporis and Profetus family. Greek Easter is a big thing amongst us Greeks, and we always used to muster at, obviously, the elder brother's house, which was in Marandera. That is how the family had bred, like rabbits. But they didn't have internet or DSTV in those days. So. All right, and if you want to have a good look here, sorry. That's my late sister Tony there. My other sister Des, who lives in America. That's Auntie Eve, Uncle Saba. That there is, no, there he is there. Your grandfather. Yeah, that's Perry there. Sorry. No, there's Perry. Perry, that's my mother, and that I think is your father. No, there. There's Uncle Gora, Dad's brother, Auntie Eve, the whole tribe out there.
Costa
there? No, they're all ugly. Costa was good looking. I can't pick him up. No. But there's Papu, Neofito, sitting there. By then, Yaya Fortuny had died from breast cancer. Sorry?
Where are you?
Where am I? I'll tell you exactly. In the arms of Papu. You must remember I was the favored one. I was the only one that Dad had. The only son. So let's move on now to the other side of the family. And there you have it. I don't quite know. That one was the wrong side. That was a more recent family reunion at Easter. And yeah, you can see the various people there. My late sister Tony. Dan, where are you? You're there somewhere. Huh? That you there? Yeah, there you go. That's Perry's wife, Maria, Auntie Mary. That's my late father. Yeah. There's Costa. Costa's there. Yeah, I mean, as I say, his brother Perry. Here he is there. Just to give you an idea, the family was, up until then, was still intact. Subsequent to that, obviously, with the change in government, etc., the family has fragmented like many others. But up until then, if you ever Googled the name Pasiporis, you would find there was only one country where the Pasiporis has lived. Yeah. And that's absolute fact. Today you Google it and it will still tell you the majority live in Zimbabwe, but the balance live in Australia, where the family have immigrated to. Okay, that was a picture of me and my daughter when I visited the village of Drusha to trace the family history, and that was in a little coffee shop on the other side of the church, the Orthodox Church in Drusha. And I arrived there, and when I got out of the car, I remember seeing two guys playing backgammon. And if you've ever watched Greeks playing backgammon, it is the most loud, lively thing you've ever heard. And they stopped, because I think I probably was something they hadn't seen before. 2 meters crawling out of a mini. And the one guy in a South African accent said, "Can I help you?" And I said to him, "Yes, I can." And he said, "Oh, are you from South Africa?" And I said, "No, I'm actually from Rhodesia." He said, "Well, I've just sold my business in Cape Town and I've moved back home to Drusha." So I said to him, "Well, listen, I'm tracing the family roots. Do you know anybody here who can point me in the direction of where my grandfather was born?" And he said, "Well, what's the name?" So I said, "Well, in Rhodesia it is Pasiporis, but here it was Hadjiagudi." He said, "Pasiporis, we know." And he said, "Come and have coffee with me, and in the meantime," he shouted down the street, and I could hear this voice picked up the tail going on the way around the little village street. And I was sitting in that coffee shop with my wife and my daughter. I had my back to the door. And I remember Sally's eyes going about this big. And she said to me, "My God, Rick, your eldest sister, much, much older, just walked in the door." And that lady there was my great aunt, Thekla. And she walked in and she had dusted herself off by the time this photo was taken, but she had her apron full of straw. She had been in the fields collecting straw for the animals. And she was very, very wary of me. Obviously, I don't look Greek. And she fired questions through the interpreter at me, left, right and center. Eventually, she was satisfied and, being typically Greek and female, big hugs and kisses and pulling of cheeks and, oh my goodness. And we were taken to where my grandfather had been born. And I was absolutely shattered. He was born in a goat shed. And that goat shed was still there, although the family now had built a house. And they were very concerned that I was coming back to claim a field. And I assured them that that was not my intention. Tables were produced. I promise you, you cannot believe the food. And the village all came round. It was the most amazing experience. The hospitality and welcoming were unbelievable. So that side is the Passapporta side. Let's move to my mother's side. The paternal side, as I said, came from Ireland. How are we doing on time? Okay. Paternal side came from Ireland and England. And this, I've got all the documentation. In fact, I have on this side as well, apart from the spoken side. Okay. Jeremiah Lewis, 1801, died in 1885. My great-great-great-grandfather, originally from Ireland. And that is the original title deed of the farm in Petty. And there it is there, it's farm number 36. And that is where the original family came from on mum's side. And there is my great-great-grandfather. Yeah, great-great-great-grandfather, Jeremiah, William Jeremiah Winson. And that gargoyle was my great-grandmother. Okay, Florence Mary Winson, born in 1868, died here in the then Salisbury in 1958. I actually met her. And let me tell you, she terrified the daylights out of me. And I'm not surprised, because she had 16 children. Seriously, 8 boys, 8 girls. They were tough in those days. And that is them much later in life, in fact in 1940, on their farm in Hatfield. There's the beginning of the 16 children. And I think there, that is my grandmother, Jessamine. And if you look there, it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Another 6 were still to come. The story is that Jessamine, my grandmother, was chasing one of her brothers around the kitchen table, and she had been cutting cloth to make a dress, and he had obviously been annoying her. And in the process of running around the table, she tripped over a chair, and the scissors she had, she stabbed him in the eye. And he subsequently became known as Uncle Winks. Okay, there we have it. Great Granny Winston, my dad, my late sister Tony, my mum, Uncle Gordon, mum's sister Thelma, Papu, funny enough, even the English family were called Papu and Yaya, Papu Brent, Mitford Brent, my sister Des, who lives in England, and Yaya, Jessamine Animal Brent, her daughter. Family picture taken. I wasn't born, so it was obviously pre-1953. There's the remainder of the family, and there's one missing. He had died at this stage of the game. But there are mother, Papu, or grandfather, who had died by then, and
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. They didn't have a picture of the other one because he died quite young. Proof that they were quite fertile. Picture of mum and dad on their wedding. And as you can see, even Popu Brent, who was well into his 60s at that stage of the game, he was a lot older than Yaya. He was still had volunteered in the Southern Rhodesian Forces, and the reason why, even at that age, and he insisted on enlisting, was because although he served in the Eastern Cape Mounted Rifles, but when he came up here, he was old and he was a farmer. So they would not let him, A, because of his age, and B, because of the fact that he was farming, volunteer for service. And he received through the mail an envelope with a white feather in it. And that really, really upset him. So at that age, he insisted on enlisting in the Southern Rhodesia Corps. There he is, very proudly in the Southern Rhodesia Army uniform, with his son-in-law, Papu Pasipotis, Fortuny, Papu Brent, and Yaya Brent on their wedding day. It was interesting that Dad came back on furlough from the war and was out on Lake Chivera, or Lake McElwain at that stage. There used to be a strip road that went out, and there was a nightclub there. And he was sitting in the nightclub in amongst some of his cronies, and across the dance floor there was a table with a whole bunch of British airmen. Because we used to have the Empire training scheme here where a lot of pilots were trained. Excuse me. And Dad looked across the dance floor and saw a very, very good looking young girl, and stupidly announced to the rest of his mates, obviously he had had a bit to drink, that he would marry that girl. Never seen her before. And halfway through the evening, with lots of joshing from his mates, he walked across the dance floor and asked if he could have a dance. In that process, he looked down and he saw an engagement ring. And a very, very English officer refused and said that this is my fiance. Dad said, all I asked for was one dance. He refused. At the end of the evening, Dad did not give up, and you couldn't get out of the nightclub through the car park because there were two big stone gateposts. And Dad lay down on the road. And when the British pilot tried to leave with his fiance, Dad refused to get up. And the gentleman eventually agreed with Dad that Dad could have one game of tennis with his fiance Ethelwyn. 2 months later, they were married. There the picture is. But in marrying, Dad was jumping the fence. He was not marrying a Greek girl. So his parents insisted that he get married in the Orthodox Church. Her parents insisted that they get married in the Presbyterian Church. So Mum and Dad had two weddings, in one either side, and I have their marriage certificates. And that actually caused an issue, because after Dad went back to the war, Mum and her best friend, who was one of her bridesmaids, Georgia Bruss from Jolson Brothers, they went to the Salisbury Show in those days, and there was a tent, and in it there was a coloured lady who read your fortune. Mum was the first to go in, and she had taken her rings off, and she was only married 2 months, so there was no shadow or anything. And she went in and sat down, and the lady used to use tarot cards. She gave them to Mum and asked her to shuffle them, which she did. Long and the short of it is, she put the cards down and looked at Mum and said, my goodness, you are too young to have been married twice. Mum said, absolute nonsense, I haven't. And she lost her sense of humour and said to him, Mum, young lady, don't lie to me. And Mum suddenly went absolutely cold. She said to her, I'm sorry. No, sorry, the fortune teller said, don't lie to me. I can see two wedding ceremonies in your cart. Mum went absolutely cold, and until the day she died, do not talk to her about fortune telling. And the Greeks turned their coffee mugs upside down, and Auntie Eve used to read the grinds as they had gone down. She believed she could read and tell a fortune. And I remember being present when she did that to my mother's cup. And my mother leant across and grabbed the cup and threw it against the wall. She refused. She did not want to know anything about the future. Anyway, I digress. What's happened? Why is it done there? I turned the damn thing off. Uh-oh. Rick, what have you done? Anyway, I think I've come to the end of the slideshow. So, no, it's fine. It was the last one. Yeah. I've got a lot of family history here and history of the country, etc. Very, very briefly, just coming through the family history. I also went to Prince Edward, same house, but the interesting thing was that my father at the time of independence was the military attaché at Rhodesia House in London. So having gone to the local schools here, I wound up going to Elmhurst Public School for Boys. And having come from here, where we went to school barefoot and in khaki shorts and khaki shirt, I arrived in England and I had to go to school in a three-piece suit, including a waistcoat. Anyway, when independence came on the 11th of November, I remember sitting in a French class and the doors had a little window. And I remember seeing Mr. Wilson, the headmaster, come and look through the window, and he looked directly at me. And behind him, there were two members of the Croydon Constabulary with their checkered caps on. And the door opened and Mr. Wilson said, can I speak to Master? Sorry, is Master Passapoulos here? And I thought, well, that's a dumb question. He's just been looking at me. And then I thought, oh, police. Yeah, well, I can't remember why the police should be here for me. Anyway, he said, can you please come and see me in my study? I went up and he got up from behind his desk and he came out and he shook my hand and he said, I'm terribly sorry, Master Passapoulos, but you may no longer attend Elmhurst Public School. I thought to myself, oof, what's happened? And he said, your Prime Minister has declared unilateral independence. Now, at the age of 12, as I was, I hadn't a clue what he was talking about. And he said, and these gentlemen from the Croydon Constabulary are here to take you home. I was put in a police car and taken home, and I've got to be honest, my dad was not one who exhibited a Greek temper. Unfortunately, I inherited that. But he was angry. He was standing in the driveway when we came back. And we were subsequently given, I think it was 2 weeks, to leave the UK. And Dad had to get the officers out of Sandhurst, Staff College, Camberley, Air Force guys, etc., etc. And we had to get on the MV Africa and sail for Cape Town. When we arrived in Dover to get aboard the ship, there were two gangplanks. Normal passengers, Rhodesians. And the Rhodesians, the one had these big tables, and we had to put all our luggage on them. And when they started to go through my mother's suitcase, my father lost his sense of humor. And he called one of the immigration officials, or customs officials. He was wearing a uniform and he actually had metal ribbons. And he called him over and he said, do you understand, young man, those ribbons are exactly the same ones that I have worn. And you are treating me like this, going through my wife's bag. The guy immediately apologized, they closed the bags and we went on board. We returned home. I was then in November, so January, I was dropped off at Prince Edward, Jameson House. I had a blazer that was 4 inches too long, it was to last the next 4 years. I walked into the junior dorm dragging my trunk behind me, and this Neanderthal, I won't mention names, was the dorm prefect. And I promise you, he looked like he shaved with a blowtorch. He was blue. And he was big, he was my size. And he sat up and he looked and he said, new boy. Ladies, I won't repeat what he said, but it was, what's your effing name? And my jaw dropped. In England, I had never heard such language. And of course, in a very plummy accent, because I'd been to an English public school, I said, Master Richard John. Bah! Over the trunk I went, and I got told that the dorm prefect did not like pommies. I promise you, by the next day, I was achentachtering and whatever, boy, I lost that accent very quickly. I too went to school. I managed to get a number of colors, and I remember getting my first one and going home and speaking to Dad, going into his study, and very proudly saying to him, I've got my first colour. And I remember he looked over his shoulder and he said, well, when you've got the other five, come and talk to me. Wow, I carried that for a long time. And much, much later, when Dad and I actually became friends, I mentioned it to him and he apologized. And he said, you have to understand that when I went to school, I was determined to be better than the rest, and I apologize that I was cavalier about it. So that was it. I then followed him into the army. In those days we had call-up, we had no option. So I always wanted to be in the army. I went to officer cadet course. I eventually got commissioned. I got what I wanted, which was to be posted to the RLI. I wound up in one commando and did a number of years there on fire force. And then I was being posted to the School of Infantry as an instructor. And I thought, no, I want to carry on with the war. Crazy what you do when you're young. So I volunteered for scouts. I passed selection course and I wound up going through various systems, troop commander, then adjutant, and then I was unbelievably lucky in given command of the external wing, which was assault group, and I finished the war there. At the independence, we were disbanded overnight. We were not allowed to wear our embellishments, web belt, combat cap, that was it. I was lucky that I was posted back to the RLI and I took over three commando, and we were kept white for 1 year, coup counter coup. A lot of people say we were stupid and that we put down the Itumbani rebellion together with the RAR, but that's by the by. One of the reasons why I'm still on my farm is that because I stayed on in the army and I got to know General Mujuru, because I was given the job of going around the assembly points and collecting volunteers, 100 Zamna, 100 Zipra, and 100 former army. We got them and I took them back to the commando barracks, and we started to run a selection course to create one Zimbabwe commando battalion. And in the process, I think in the first week, I must have fired about 40. They were useless. 2 days later, I was summoned to what they called in those days JHC, Joint High Command, where Army Headquarters is now, Josiah Tongogara Barracks. And I remember walking into the ops room and sitting in front of me was General Mujuru. On his left was Josiah Tungumurai, who became the commander of the Zimbabwe Air Force, both Zamna. The next one was Lookout Mutsuku and Dumisa Dubengwa. And on this side was Walls and McLean. And the first thing Rex Nyong'o said to me was, Mangwanani Matungugole, Karapasi. And that shocked me, because he knew my Chimuringa name, my war name, and he knew that I spoke Shona. And I thought, oof, I'm in trouble here. I looked at the two white generals, they looked down, they never looked up the entire process. I sat down, and across the table came an A4 piece of paper, and I was told, you will put these people back in the commander battalion. I looked at the list, and there must have been about 18 or 19 on there, and they were the worst of the worst. And I said that. I said, I can't do that. They are the worst. And if ever you knew General Nyong'o, he had a stutter and it got worse when he got angry. And he said to me, you can't say that, they are connected. I said, connected? Connected to you, God? He said, they are connected. I'm giving you an order. I stood up, took my rank off my shoulders and I put it on the table and I said, I never attested into the Zimbabwe Army. I resign. I am a professional officer. I will not sign off on these people. They shouldn't even be in the army, let alone special forces. With that, and if ever you knew Dumisa Dubengwa, you remember him. You were incarcerated with him, weren't you? He had a deep voice, huh? And he started to laugh. And Rex looked at him and said, Dumisa, have you got something to say? And he said, yes, Rex. Listen to Mutungugule. He is a regular officer. We are guerrillas. We want a proper army. Blow me down, Josiah Tungumurai, Zanna. Said, I agree. Two white generals never said a word. And my admiration for Rex Nyong'o started there, because he looked, he leaned across the table, he took back that piece of paper, crunched it up, threw it on the floor, picked up my rank and held it like this. And he stuttered, said,
Tugoguri, you went cheeky effing bastard, go and do your job. Put my rank back, and I saluted, and I went back to the commando battalion, and I ran the selection course. About 5 days later, he pitched up. And he walked and toured the whole selection process, and at the end of it, he shook my hand and said, I understand what you're doing. So I said to him, we'll come and have lunch in the officer's mess. He said, no. You and me, we will go and eat in the troops canteen. Again, my admiration for him stood. Sad day. Sad day. In my opinion, when he was killed, because he was definitely killed, for the country. He was a man who had absolutely no chip on his shoulder at all. But just before I left the army, and I left because someone was promoted above me who couldn't read or write, I remember going to see him. And I took that scrapbook, and in that scrapbook is a picture of his Land Rover and his Land Cruiser in Mozambique with bullet holes in it. And he took one look at it, he got up and walked around his desk and he shook my hand. And he said, you were prepared to die, so was I. Let's go forward. Good man. Years later, when the farm invasions happened, I was on Bushman Rock and I had these wonderful creatures who probably weren't even born when the war was on, claiming to be war vets hanging off the gate. I remember phoning General Nyong'o and saying to him, this is what I've got. And I had to laugh. He said to me, how many have you shot? I said, I haven't shot any yet. He said, don't. About an hour and a half later, a troop carrier arrived from the commander battalion. And let me tell you, those young war vets, they got the biggest hiding of their lives and I never saw them again. A man of his word. Ladies and gentlemen, that brings me to the end of my chat. There's various books and stuff here. I make no apologies for some of the content that's in those scrapbooks. You're very welcome to go through it. There's pictures of Dad's old rugby team when he was at Prince Edward, etc. You might pick up some names that you know. But that brings the two sides of the family together. So thank you very much for your attention.
Of course. Okay, Rick, we'll take some questions if anybody has. I'll let you do direct answer.
But bear in mind, being Greek, I might not answer correctly. Yes, Tim.
Rick, you were deficient by recording one eye. How have you gone into the army at all?
Tim. Okay. When my dad was an instructor at the School of Infantry, he was chief instructor there. In those days, we used to get dry rations issued to the married quarters. And they arrived in boxes wrapped with steel baling wire. And I remember helping my mother in the kitchen. And I pulled the end of a baling wire and it flicked up and hit me in my right eye. And of course, I think I was 5 at the time. Of course, I pulled it out. And that wasn't very clever. So a stream of blood hit my mom on her apron, and she was unbelievable. She grabbed me, basically took me to hospital, and they bound it up. There was an incredible doctor there called Jeff Fine, Jewish doctor, who actually had specialized in eyes. And I remember now being bandaged, and I could hear Dad's stick boots coming up the corridor. I was like, oof, I'm going to get a hiding here. Anyway, he walked up and Jeff Fine said, listen, we need to take your son into the operating theatre. We need to remove his eye. And Dad said, you're not taking his eye out. And I subsequently asked him why. And in fact, we were walking in Salisbury on First Street. And a guy shouted, Captain Passy. And he came walking across the road and he had this one orb that didn't move. He had a glass eye. And it was Dad's sergeant who had taken a piece of shrapnel in Italy. And he said to me, that is why I argued with the surgeon. I didn't want you to end up with this glass eye. Long story short, I was in hospital for a long time. They were worried that in those days that septicemia would set in, so Dad had a chair next to my bed. And for the next 3 days, he didn't move. Every hour he would lift up a bandage and this Greek schmezel would come in and he would suck in oxygen to see if there was any corruption. I retained my eye, but blind in this one.
So I knew that when I wanted to go on regular officer course, I had to pass the medical. The doctor in the Dad's regiment, in the 2nd Battalion, King's African Rifles in Nyasaland, was Captain Paul Pickles. By the time Dad was in charge of the brigade was when I was now applying to become an officer, and I knew that Captain Paul Pickles was now Colonel Paul Pickles, and he was the brigade medical officer. And I also knew that by 10 o'clock in the morning, Captain Paul Pickles, pickled by name, pickled by nature. So I pitched up and I walked in and I go, oh, listen, how lovely to see you. What can I do for you? I said, I've come to get my medical for officer selection. Oh, wonderful. He took the heart, blood pressure, all the rest of it. And then he said, let's do the eyes. Put your right hand over your right eye, no problem. This is 2020. Brrr. Put your left hand over your left eye, whoop, brrr. 6666. Off I went to officer's course. There you go. Come. Right. Yes, sir. In what, Neofito? There's no exact date that I've got, but if I go back to when they were married and work out that he was at least single for 4 or 5 years, he must have arrived about 1914, 1915. Yeah. Yes, sir.
Irish song.
Yes.
1827.
Yes.
Do you happen to know what ship?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. I can look it up for you. Put up. Okay. William Winson, born England, 1799. Left, so I can only give you the English one. Left on the ship Norfolk and settled in Queenstown. And he earned a living carrying goods by wagons. He married Mary Ann Lewis and he was killed when the wagon that he was moving supplies on fell on him at the foot of Penhope Pass in 1840. And he had two sons and a daughter, and was married. Was buried under the fig tree near where he was crushed.
I ask because there's one 1827 descendant over there, Fraser, and my wife also, but they were in the Northampton.
My God, I hope they didn't get together on the ship, and I found other people who remember my family. Thanks for that. Great.
In that case, we'll call upon Lou Roberts to come and thank you.
Yes.
I remember the kid passing through the zebra.
Yes. Correct. Yes. That's an interesting subject because I only found out. I knew about the younger brother who came out for a short time and then went back to Drusha and became a layman in the Orthodox Church. But the middle brother is the one that came out and settled in Gadzima. And he, I can't remember the name of the hotel and store. In 2 seconds, I will get it for you. Yeah, Little Rocks Hotel and Store and Butchery in Gadzima, and that was Theofani. And he eventually married a divorcee, Helen Plagius. And she came with 4 children, and they subsequently had 4 of their own. And one of the sons was Johnny Plagius, DFC, DSO and Bar, shot down 3 times over Malta. And sadly, like a lot of the guys, and being a war hero, came back and was feted and whatever, had a road named after him, etc., and then became a complete alcoholic. Yeah.
This Johnny Plagius, I'm not sure if it's the same one that my parents knew, did he dabble in emeralds?
Yes.
Yes.
It must be the same
daughter. Yeah.
He used to come down to Barra.
Correct.
My mother used to write out export papers pretending a Mozambique emeralds being exported rather than Rhodesian to beat the sanctions.
Not only emeralds, but all things.
Again, I come back to that point. Anything to do with illegal gold, emeralds, gun running or whatever, the Greeks are there.
Okay.
Yes.
Can I still one more question? One more coming.
Where did your father come from? What year did he leave?
Well, Dad was born 1922. He would have gone when he was 13, add that on. Well, I've got it right here, hold on, I'll tell you.
1940.
Okay, so he was winners of the Rhodesian Schools cricket, 1939.
He was the same as my father.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it would be. You'll probably find some of your dad's. In fact, I think I've got a photo of my father and all the prefects, because he was a prefect, he wasn't head boy. Anyway, it's here somewhere. Yeah.
Okay, folks, we have a time constraint on this very moment, so I think we need to ask Ray to come and thank me formally for a very, very fascinating.